Chapter 3. The diminished, but still well-manned Surprise and her lithe fore-and-aft companion Ringle swung easily at their moorings on the making tide, not far from the imposing Suffolk, and they gazed at the South African squadron farther inshore, actively victualling, watering, and getting ready to move into various docks and yards beyond the citadel for repairs, some of them urgent. "Good morning, Stephen," said Jack, as his friend walked into the cabin.
"Good morning to you, my dear," said Stephen.
"You've done your writing, I see." "So I have too. A simple, harsh direction that Bridget shall be delivered into the hands of the bearer and carried aboard, whichever vessel we decide upon, there to be in her father's custody. This is, as I understand it, a necessary legal form in case any of Diana's relatives should object. It is, I hope, entirely softened by a most affectionate private note to Christine and her brother, inviting them to join us. I've done much the same, simply requiring Sophie to come aboard with the utmost dispatch, bringing a minimum of impediments, and, of course, the girls." Each eyed the other's letter, which looked more like a laboured study than a simple note, and Jack said, "Well, let's at least have a preliminary cup, and then we can ask Harding to join us." Some moments later he touched the bell and said to Killick, "Ask Mr. Harding to walk in." "Mr. Harding, pray sit down. May I pour you a cup of coffee? Now, you know very well that Surprise and Ringle are to return to Portsmouth with all possible speed to deliver a certain number of officers to the Commander-in-Chief, together with the Doctor's communications and my dispatches. You may find it possible to shape your course without any impropriety, so that you touch at Shelmerston before heading for Plymouth. If it's feasible, you, a firm-natured married man, will post straight to Woolcombe, and there hand this letter to my wife and this to Mrs. Wood, her near neighbour. Our hope, you see, is to convey both ladies, together with Mrs. Wood's brother, the three children, and the strict minimum attendance to the Cape, either catching the squadron before it leaves the River Plate or joining company during the voyage. They'll almost certainly water at St. Helena, or simply at the Cape itself. Now, you know both vessels through and through, and you know more than I do about children, attendance, and the married state. When you've heard the ladies express their views on baggage and on these points, you will form an opinion on the irreducible minimum and choose your conveyance accordingly. Ringle is undoubtedly faster than Surprise, but I shouldn't like to have her passengers unduly cramped, given a disgust of the sea, for the sake of a few days." "Two ladies, one gentleman, three children, and I suppose three or four maids and a man." "Well, it does, of course, depend on whether the gentleman chooses to come," observed Jack. "Mr. Harding, you'll read these letters, if you please. They are in no way confidential."
"I make no doubt that a gentleman will come," said Stephen.
Harding, a poised middle-aged lieutenant, read the letters with attention. The others watched him. "Well, sir," he said at last, "well, gentlemen, I am of opinion that Ringle is the right choice. I was perpetually easing my sheet when she was in company with Surprise, though, indeed, there are few faster frigates. The passengers will not lie altogether at their ease, to be sure, but they will have the delight of seeing the bow wave flung wide to leeward, and the wake racing away, everything alive and tearing through the water. There would be dull souls that didn't love that. And if I may be so bold, Miss Bridget loved it purely last time she was afloat in a blow. Anyhow, you want Ringle as a tender, sir." "Very true. So you think all these people could be crammed in?" "I shall take my Davy on it, sir." "Very well. You can say I was surprised then, and she'll deliver my officers, passengers and dispatches at Portsmouth, then run down to be laid up in Sepping's Yard, while you return with your passenger, Ringle." "Very good, sir."
said Harding, folding the letters away in his bosom. "So now, since the gentlemen for Portsmouth are already aboard, Surprise, I shall ask permission to take my leave and wish you and Suffolk a happy, prosperous voyage. And, Doctor, how I hope you and your mate may bag a brace or two of phoenixes." They shook hands and parted. "There's a fine fellow," said Jack. "He can sail the schooner very, very hard indeed. It was the right choice. But I think he wasn't mistaken when he said that they wouldn't always lie at their ease." It would be ill-natured on my part to suggest that he might be influenced by the certainty under Providence of coming back to your blue squadron and acting as tender to the imposing great Suffolk under your command. I shall not say it, however, although my lower being does feel exceptionally bad-tempered today. Jack, with your idea, you have wholly forestalled me. You spoke of a notion worthy of Newton, but you didn't elaborate. And I was only waiting for an opportunity of telling you. Pray do so now, dear Stephen. I'm sure it would be more luminous. What I was going to say was that you had no idea of the fundamental difference between a mere landlubber and a seaman. How was you indeed? You may toss your head in that superior way, but you have never been a mere landlubber. You were introduced to the ocean as an infant child. You boated before you knew the difference between right and wrong. You went positively to sea under Captain Willis well before puberty. Far from you the wondering calf-like gaze of those who watched the intrepid mariner traverse the tossing deck, the gaze almost instantly followed by a feeling of unavoidable and certain death, cold death, followed by furious, uncontrollable heaves and shameless vomiting, morbid figure and despair. They, with some slight recovery and even an upright position, the sight of these godlike creatures stalking about the nightmare deck in their uncouth garments, uttering their brutish cries, hailing upon robes great and small, finding their way by night, reaching the stated port, all this reduces the lubber to a state of laudable and permanent humility. No, no, my good sir, you may say what you please, but there is a great gulf fixed between the landlubber who comes late to things that float, and the true-born seaman, a gulf as great as that between a sheep and a seal. Very true, said Jack, who had had the training of some of the sheep. Now, you are to consider, Stephen went on, that my Bridget was not only baptised in sea water, but dipped before she could walk. When we were ashore, she rejoiced in boats. When we were afloat, she delighted in heavy sea, never minding in the least when they soaked her through and through, nimble in the rigging, the darling of the upper yardmen. She often explains the rigging to me, and I've seen old hands like Tobin nod with approval. No, my dear Jack, what I should have said, had you not, in essence, said it before me, was that one, however young, who has sea legs, sea sense, and the knowledge both acquired and to some degree, as it were, instinctive of the sea's very nature itself, bears down all frippery land-based experience, however old. Now, come, Stephen. Charlotte and what's-her-name are not exactly crones. As I remember, they only date from the Mauritius campaign. They might have been born with Helen of Troy, as far as that is concerned. Aboard, particularly aboard so lithe and eager a vessel as Ringle, Bridget must bear them down. Either just equilibrium will be reached with mutual respect and no bullying. There were many vantage points high above the harbour that Jack and Stephen used to climb. Once a reasonable period elapsed, a period in which a well-handled weatherly craft with favourable winds, and as far as could be told they had been favourable, could reasonably be expected to sail out and back. and Stephen had the pleasure of seeing some moderately upland birds and the bizarre mating habits of a colony of variegated scorpions, while the sun passed over the almost invariable translucent sky. But Jack always made his descent to the still fairly active yards, Lord Leighton's mainmast footing still gave great trouble, with hope disappointed. By now Suffolk was in very fine fig, and since Jack was blessed with an experienced and, upon the whole, intelligent wardroom, the gun crews, at least in dumb show, were as brisk as he could wish, while the small arms men who could within limits fire their pieces were all well above the average. Their stores were completed, prime salt beef from the immense ranches, smaller amounts of moderate pork, a remarkably agreeable army biscuit, tobacco in industrial quantities, while for daily use, flesh boats plied to and from the butcher's stalls along the quay, and flat-bottomed craft brought fruit and vegetables in unlimited amount. As a peacemaker, the nuncio had worked wonders. Though to be sure, commercial enterprise had played its part. "It's only a Friday," said Jack, when he and his first lieutenant, he sailed without a flag captain, had made sure that there wasn't a becket out of place and that all Suffolks were present, correctly shaved, and provided with all that was required. "It's only a Friday. But I think I shall stroll up well beyond our usual mound with a telescope. Do you choose to come, Stephen?"
"I do too. We might see some of the first migrants."
Up and up. Fairly easy going now that they were used to the land. And as they rose, the horizon increased enormously. The empty horizon, though in with the land there were some lateen-rigged fishermen. The mound they chose was thinly covered with a sparse herbage in which there grew a small, particularly vicious cactus, while in the many bare places the earth showed dull, purplish-red. A landscape more wholly foreign they had never seen, although they'd travelled very, very widely. It was, after all, their calling. "Dear Lord," said Jack, sitting comfortably down, his back to a rock, after a piercing search of the nearer sea and the northern horizon, "how I long for Woolcombe and the green Woolhampton Downs, speckled with sheep. Woolcombe and the soft dew falling, the cawing of rooks. Well, I was a mere post-captain, you know, and there was this prospect of peace. I used to console myself, particularly when I was solvent again, with that dear prize money and Cousin Edward's land doing so well. I used to console myself with the thought of restoring the place to what it was when I was a boy, before my father lost his head about the stock exchange, when we had a pack of hounds and a damn good huntsman, and when the water bailiff kept the streams as neat as a man of war, full of trout and the odd salmon on the spring run. Lord, we had such sport, such fun. There was an old hound called Captain, and he always hit off the line after a check. "Hark to Captain," we would cry, and they all followed him like a single creature. Lord, how I long to be back. Now, of course, I must stand my trick as a flag officer, and most uncommon lucky I am to have it to do. But I do so long to be back sometimes, under Hamble Down, showing George how to work out a line. Stephen, you could have no idea how beautiful it is.
Can I not?
Now, of course you can, of course you can. I'm sure the glens of Avoca are even finer. I do beg your pardon. But you see, it was my childhood. Have you noticed that small vessel right in with the land almost beneath us under the cliff? Her sails are all in a line. Jack leapt to his feet. By God, she's Ringo, he cried. She must have stood in shore. The voice and the explanation died on the downward slope. I should never have believed that a man so tall and stout could have moved so fast, murmured Stephen, fixing the schooner in his glass. He liked to believe that he could make out Bridget and Christine with Edward Heatherly clinging to a spar behind them, but it was clearly time to descend. The perilous slope, the milder slope, the mule track, the paved road, and at last the quays, with Jack still far, far ahead, though now moving more like an admiral. Ringle was a beautifully proportioned vessel, and it was only when there was a tight knot of people on her forecastle that one saw how small she was, in fact. Kindly hands heaved on the mooring ropes to let Stephen step aboard from the quay, and clear over the general din he heard the Aubrey Twins' shrill cry raised for the seventh time, "Why are you not wearing your admiral's uniform?" While at the same time his own Bridget slipped through the thong and whispered, "Dearest Papa," as he bent to kiss her. Christine was just behind, and looking up from the child's shining, happy, sun-brown face, he said, "Dear Christine, she does you infinite credit. Edward, my dear sir, how do you do? How happy I am to see you." The visitors' cabins had long since been prepared, and now the admiral's barge carried them over. After their extraordinarily rapid but somewhat cramped voyage, they were amazed by the scale of a ship of the line. "It's almost as good as Greenyon's Hotel," said Charlotte, which earned her a sour look from Killick. "And have you noticed that the sails are square?" asked her sister, to which Bridget replied, "Don't you know the odds between a ship and a schooner?" with such firmness and such effect that Stephen saw with infinite satisfaction that a decent balance had been established. Then again Bridget knew quantities of old surprises, some of whom had taught her the ropes. These she found out and asked them how they did, calling them by name, which put her head and shoulders above any passenger but Mrs. Aubrey. In any case, the twins never entered into competition. As might have been predicted, they'd been dreadfully seasick, confined to their bunks, horrible to see and worse to hear from the very beginning until a few days ago, so that they had acquired no sea legs, no fundamental knowledge, and even now they were incapable of distinguishing a bowline from a rolling hitch. Yet, in a surprisingly short time, as it's measured by days, the new inhabitants of the Suffolk, even the more stupid of the Aubrey girls, took bells for granted, the ritual swabbing of decks, set meals, less Spartan now that they lay in port, and the many and very fine gradations that separated the rear admiral from the boy third class. Stephen observed with a mute but intense satisfaction that here his daughter had not the least air of being a stranger in the house, a friend's child accepted for that friend's sake. Here, with so many friends, and accompanied by Pardine, an old surprise of remarkable standing and authority, she was very much at home. Yet as far as he could see, she didn't flaunt her sea-going knowledge. But as soon as the twins were willing to be peaceable, she was both kind and companion-like. Very soon they'd explored almost every part of the ship, from the safer tops, propelled by Pardine and other seamen, to the echoing vaults of the darkened hold, where facetious midshipmen and first-class volunteers would terrify them with sepulchral moans and waving sheets. "Dearest Stephen," said Sophie, passing him a cup of tea in the cabin, "I cannot tell you how glad I am that our daughters are friends again. There was a time when I almost despaired, when I should have whipped them if I hadn't thought it'd do more harm than good." It only made me dogged when I was young.
I cannot imagine you being whipped, Sophie,
said Christine.
But I was, and quite often too. My mother would make us stand with our faces to the wall and whip the backs of our legs with a thin sheaf of willow wands. I don't think it ever improved my French verbs or arithmetic, or even my manners.
I knew some Dominican nuns who did that, said Stephen. They whipped my Saavedra cousins until they bled. I thought it was only Catholic. Jack hardly ever flogs, discourages it indeed.
How do you find him, my dear?
Oh, very well, I thank you, said Sophie, blushing. I must admit he is rather thinner than I could wish, but he does love having his flag, and I'm so very, very happy for him. It was Prince William who sent us the news with his best compliments, which I thought wonderfully polite. The three little girls came in, since if there was tea, there might also in the nature of things be cake, or at least muffin. On seeing Stephen, they stopped, not looking very wise, and made a concerted bob. Then Bridget ran over to him and said, "Oh, sir, the Admiral says a Portuguese came in with the flood and he hopes there may be some mail. A boat pulled across to the flag not long since." "I shall go upstairs, and I shall go on deck and ask whether it would be proper to inquire. Ladies, forgive me, I beg."
"No, it would be most improper." Jack was surprised that a man who had seen so much sea time could suppose a thing possible or even decent. It wasn't exactly mutinous, but it would deserve and certainly receive an exceptionally hard reproach. But in any case, Stephen was talking great nonsense. The Portuguese had been aboard Lord Leighton this hour and more, and there had been no sign of mail, nothing handed up the side, no passing out of bags, no hurrying to and fro. No! The boat had done nothing more than deliver a gentleman. The gentleman in regimentals, who was now walking up and down the quarter-deck with the Admiral arm in arm. I've been staring at him with my glass in this ill-bred fashion for some little time, said Jack. For although I think I know the face and carriage, I cannot put a name to either. Should you like to take a look?
Sure, it is very ill-bred. But I might, to make you easy.
Stephen took the telescope, focused it, and almost at once, as the two men on the far ship turned, he said coldly, "It's Henry Miller. He was at Trinity in my time, and he killed Edward Taff in the 15 acres when I was in my last year."
"Miller?" "Yes, of course, my neighbour over by Caxley. He must be related to the Admiral, Miller's Lord Leighton's family name. That person over there often spoke of a peerage going to some fairly close connection. Cousin, of course. They wouldn't be walking arm in arm otherwise."
After a pause, Jack went on, "What do you mean by your 15 acres?
"It's a space in the Phoenix Park. You know the great park in Dublin, I'm sure," Jack nodded, "and that's where people go, particularly the young men of Trinity, to settle matters of honour."
"Just so.
And he killed a gunner officer in Malta, too. He's said to be a very good shot and he has capital pistols. I've heard him called Hare Trigger Miller, and to be sure I've seen him bring down a great many pheasants."
"Would you say he was a quarrelsome man at all?"
"I scarcely know him. We are necessarily acquainted, but he's not the sort of man whose acquaintance I should value. In short, I don't like him. It's not the fighting. As you know, duels are much more usual in the army than with us, or even the Marines. And anyhow, you and I have both been out from time to time. Cannot top it, the Holy Joe." Jack stared out over the water and went on, "For all I know, he may be well enough liked in his regiment. But his reputation in the neighbourhood is so indifferent that I was astonished to learn that he'd called on Edward and Christine when they settled in Medenham,
and then at Woolcombe when Christine was staying there with Edward so far in the north. I've no room to blackguard a man for incontinence, being no model myself, but there are limits. You know very well, Stephen, how much influence a man with a large household and a considerable estate can bring to bear on his dependents, daughters. And there were some very ugly tales of girls in child being turned away. I know very little. Yet his conduct does seem to match with the general reprobation. He's not married, I take it? No, nor ever has been. Being almost next in succession to the latent title, he's said to be saving himself up for some very brilliant match. Can you square a man's valuing a peerage very highly when he's going out and risking his life so often? Yes, if he's an unusually resentful, unloved creature, and at the same time an uncommon good shot. Sir, if you please, said the officer of the watch, stepping aft and taking off his hat. Flag is breaking out a signal. Speaking in the high staccato expressionless voice used on such occasions, the duty midshipman piped up, Flag to Suffolk. Admiral invites Rear Admiral and Dr. M-A-T-U-R-I-N to dinner at 3:15. Repeat, 3:15. Rear Admiral to Flag, very happy, Sir Jack in italics. Then he hurried aft to Stephen's point of discreet withdrawal. Stephen, I've engaged you to dine with the Admiral tomorrow. I hope you don't mind it. I don't mind it, my dear, and it wouldn't make odds if I did. We are all worms under the harrow in the service. Even you, Jack, scintillating in gold lace, are but one of us. I say come, and he cometh, for I am a centurion. I've met few admirals. Some high, mighty, and almost certainly constipated. Others small, jolly, good company, reading men even. Besides, I long for men's company. The prattle of the little girls, much though I love them, drives me to an earlier and earlier breakfast, to a later and even later dinner, so that presently the two will meet, as they did in Avicenna's tale. They come to me with a pelagic crab, a starfish, a piece of common rack, and standing by my side they cry, Oh, sir, pray tell us what it is, so that I'm tempted to utter obscene blasphemy. Oh, how I long for dear Jacob's return. I believe our departure depends largely on that, said Jack gravely. And then after a pause, I tell you what, Stephen, he cried, it's long since we had a real great gun exercise. The last powder, hoy, for a trifle of whisky. You know the Irish drink, Stephen, I'm sure. I've never heard of it, said Stephen. Gave us a little surplus, so that the gunners actually at a loss to stow it. Nothing could be happier. And if that doesn't deafen, astound and silence the little girls, there's the devil in it. I shall give orders directly. The whole shooting match! Jack didn't often stumble on a witticism, and this one gave him particular delight. He repeated it twice. The whole shooting match it was indeed. Suffolk might not have been called a very taut ship, nor more than ordinarily crack, but she could never have been likened to the Margate Hoy. And in any case, she now carried many surprises, long used to their captain's ways and his rigid insistence upon very high standards indeed. The breeze being both steady and favourable, Jack laid on his favourite, most profitable form of exercise, one calculated to promote zeal, speed, and above all accuracy, to knit a gun crew into an immensely cooperative whole, never a word passing, never a word called for, and to promote the most valuable sort of competition. The most experienced gun captains and the older, wiser midshipmen were at the three forward guns, and bitter shame would fall upon any following gun that could not keep up with them in speed or accuracy. The first three guns had been ordered to fire high, to leave something for the rest of the broadside. And Jack, as a particular treat, silencer or gobstopper for the little girls, had, with Mr. Mears the gunner, contrived a flimsy but coherent structure that, under very light and worn-out canvas, would drift until it was abreast of the man-of-war, which would then pound it with the most rapid broadside compatible with the Suffolk's timbers, a broadside rolling but only just rolling.
"Targets away!" hailed the fore topmast lookout. "On deck there, targets away!"
"From forward aft as she bears," called Jack. And there was a long, tense silence, broken only by the gentle wind in the rigging. The little girls in white frocks stood on tiptoe. Just behind them, Sophie and Christine almost equally tense. The captain of Number One glared along his sights, the lanyard in his right hand, his left making very slight, delicate motions to swivel or elevate the huge gun barrel right or left, up or down a trifle. "Fire!" he cried, and heaved on the lanyard. The hammer shot forward, and with barely a perceptible pause, the gun uttered its prodigious roar, a great jet of smoke and flame enveloping the cannonball, and the gun carriage and cannon raced inboard with a screech of trunnions under the arched bodies of the crew, until the hull was brought up short with a great twang of the tackles. But already there were immensely active hands, cleaning all the smouldering remnants from the gun, swabbing the barrel, ramming down the next charge of powder, then the ball, then the wads, well thumped down, the crew barely pausing for breath, but running the whole mass up against the side with a crash, where the gun captain pricked and primed his cock, unmoved by the truly appalling discharge of his right-hand neighbour, as he and his mates made all fast and levelled the warm gun again. The firing went clean down the battleship's side at a fine, even pace, and even the aftermost piece had it shot at the frail remnant that drifted by. But by then the little girls had almost no voice to screech with, nor even the emotional power to do so. The enormous and repeated din, the vibration of the ship and the air, the great flashes and the dense clouds of smoke drifting away to leeward had overpowered them. And the near stupefaction of their elders was very impressive too. Sophie had seen sloops and moderate frigates at gun exercise, but never a ship of the line, and she was quite remarkably perturbed, not only by the unconscionable din, but infinitely more by the reflection that this was what his profession inflicted upon her husband, or at least the way of life to which it exposed him. Christine, to be sure, had fired many and many a fowling piece, and even upon occasion a rifled gun, but nothing imaginably on this scale. And she remained quite mute, holding Bridget's hand, until after a good deal of calling out right forward, the cry came down, "On deck there! On deck there! Targets away, sir!" So it was. A great, long affair of all kinds of old casks and nameless objects from the entire squadron, clapped together and furnished with enough cloth of a sort to carry the whole downwind. The target appeared on the starboard bow, towed by boats that cast off as soon as it was well on course. An active, intelligent master's mate ran down the broadside. "No fire until the Admiral gives the word. Then count two between each shot." A profound silence. The target drifted halfway down the Suffolk's length. "Fire!" said Jack. The first gun, and before it quite ran in the second, and so clear along down to the last. And when the smoke cleared, and the last repeated echo died away, there was nothing but tossing water to be seen. The little girls had strength enough to utter a last gasping, "Oh!" And then they were led away exhausted. But not before a furious Kinnick had appeared on the quarter-deck, waving a full-dress coat. "Which I had it all laid out a quarter of an hour long past. Ain't you got..." He was going to say no shame, but disapproving looks coupled with Jack's compliance and a call for the barge checked his zeal. With a following breeze and a very well-inclined crew, the barge fairly skimmed across the sea, hooking on, only a matter of seconds late. In any case, Lord Leighton was in a good mood. He could be jovial and he could be damn crabbed, but this was a good day. He'd heard much of Dr. Maturin's acquaintance, close acquaintance with Prince William, who, in view of his elder brother's constitution, was likely to be king in the early foreseeable future. "Well, Aubrey," he cried, giving his guest a hand as he came aboard, "you very nearly split the heavens with that damn great rolling broadside. Gosh, my life! Thunder and lightning was nothing to compare. Don't I wish you may not have started more than a dozen of your timbers? And don't I wish you may have come by your powder honestly? Allow me to present my young cousin Randolph Miller," beckoning to a soldier in regimentals smiling just behind him. "But of course you know him already. Your neighbours in the country." "How do you do, sir?" said Jack, accepting Miller's proffered hand. "And this, sir, is Dr. Maturin, I presume?" said Lord Leighton. "How kind of you to come. I've had a particular desire to meet you ever since the Duke of Clarence told me you were a most uncommonly learned man. I'm not particularly learned myself, but I'd love to surround myself with those that are. May I introduce you to Captain Miller, my cousin Randolph? But now I come to reflect, perhaps a doctor of medicine takes rank over a simple soldier." "Not at all, my lord. But it so happens that we were at Trinity at much the same time, so I already have that honour." "Indeed he was. Trinity College, Dublin. Well, then, if he too were at Trinity, then he too is one of the learned. It stands to reason. And I dare say he can split an infinitive as quick as any man. But may I introduce..." Presently they were called to the Admiral's truly splendid dining cabin, which could seat 10 people easily, each with a servant behind his chair, and plenty of room for those who came hurrying in with dishes and tureens, sauce boats, trays of bread, and, of course, very large quantities of wine. A grateful Sancerre with the Bonito, an Aubryant with the admirable duck, and an ancient Burgundy with the roast beef. Unhappily, it was corked. The chaplain on Stephen's right murmured something about a quaint reminiscence of antiquity, and Jack didn't empty his glass. But their host took no notice of his formal first sip, and none of his officers showed any sign of awareness. "Stoicism?" asked Stephen privately. "Dislike of offending the great man? Discipline? Stark insensibility?" When it came to the port, however, the case was altered. All hands, including the parson, drank eagerly, and when they reached the loyal toast, there was no man who did not drain his brimming glass and murmur, "God bless him," with real feeling, and emptied it. After this ceremony and the chaplain's grace, Lord Leighton observed that, although the glass was sinking, it was still quite a fine afternoon, and some of them might like to take their coffee, and perhaps some brandy, on deck. There were general sounds of agreement, a general movement, though with due regard for precedence, and the Admiral, keeping Jack by his side until the room was free, said, in answer to his thanks and congratulations, "Not at all, not at all, my dear fellow, a very simple little feast. Though I must admit they have capital beef in these parts. But did you notice anything about the Burgundy?" "No, sir, capital wine." "Well, I'm glad of that. For a moment I thought... But, however, what I wanted to tell you before coffee was that I should like you to weigh on the ebb and to proceed to St. Helena under a very easy sail, and there to wait in that damned uneasy roadstead until you see me plain. Then you must weigh and carry on for the Cape. There's not room for all three squadrons to lie there safely together in a strong sou'wester, but that will already make a very impressive show of force, I believe.
Certainly, sir.
And then I should like you to take my nephew along with you. As you may know, he's been given an appointment at the Cape, and the sooner he's there, the better. You might even lend him your tender for the last few days if the wind drops, as it so often does as you approach the coast. Now, let's hurry on deck before all those goddamn soldiers have drunk all the brandy. On deck, Captain Miller at once came up to Jack and said, "Sir, I hear with great pleasure that Mrs. Aubrey and Mrs. Wood are both aboard you, and that perhaps we may be shipmates as far as the Cape. Allow me to fetch you a glass of brandy." Coming back with a glass in his hand, he cried, "My dear cousin has just told me that you will be so very kind as to take me with you. Thank you very much indeed. I did myself the pleasure of waiting on Mr. Heatherley when he and his sister, whom I already knew and admired from my days in Sierra Leone, were settling at Medenham. And later I call on Mrs. Aubrey and Mrs. Wood at Woolcombe when you were still at sea. I must congratulate you on your children, sir." Jack looked at him with some surprise. Their degree of acquaintance didn't warrant anything like this familiarity. "Has the man drunk too much?" he wondered inwardly. Aloud he said, "Forgive me, if you please," and walked across the deck to where Dr. Maturin was listening sullenly to Lord Leighton's harangue, his detailed explanation of how he was going to tell Napoleon how he could have avoided defeat at Waterloo. "Aubrey," cried Leighton, turning, "cannot you persuade or even order Dr. Maturin to stay while I have my interview with the Emperor, with General Bonaparte, I should say? I can read the French pretty well with a dictionary at hand, but I cannot speak it with anything like the doctor's fluency." "Oh, come, my lord," said Stephen. "What you say sounds..."